Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What sort of leaders have had the greatest impact on Latin American life over the past century ago, and how have vastly divergent viewpoints on political power, justice, democracy, and revolution shaped Latin American culture? In his newest book, journalist and author Enrique Krause discusses the influence of a dozen key figures in Latin America, from Cuban journalist and poet José Martí in the late 19th century through Venezuela's Hugo Chávez in the 21st, exploring how each has shaped Latin Americans' understanding of their nation's place in the larger world and of their individual rights and roles in their own countries. The book is called Redeemers, Ideas and Power in Latin America, and it's now available in paperback. Enrique, welcome to Think.
I'm so glad to be in your program, Chris.
Let's start by talking about your title. What sorts of redeemers have Latin Americans elevated over the past century, and what have they craved redemption from?
Curiously, I owe the title to Mario Vargas Llosa. When I spoke to him several times, he's one of the figures that I study in the book, and I spoke with him about the book. He said, I told him, you see, what I'm studying here is the history of revolutionary passion in Latin America, which is a very deep passion through the ages in Latin America. And for me, I told him, revolutionary passion has a religious element in it, in its essence, and it's like a redeeming element. And he said, there you have the title, Redeemers. So I owe him the title. But I was serious saying that in these deeply Catholic countries, the revolutionary ideas, for instance, of Marxism during the 20th century, were lived with revolutionary feeling and with a revolutionary zeal. And not unlike the intellectuals and leaders of Russia. So there is a link between the fire in the minds of Russian leaders and the fire in the minds of Latin American leaders and writers.
You start the book with a discussion of José Martí, who you have called Latin America's first modern writer. Talk about the role he played in Cuba's liberation from Spanish colonial rule.
I think, first of all, it is the more lovable, likable, admirable figure in Latin America. Truly, I think that. His life was a tragic life, but truly exemplary life, of a great writer who renewed the Spanish language and poetry and prose, who couldn't find a country to call his own because he couldn't go back to Cuba, that was at that time the last part of the Spanish dominion. And, he became a New Yorker. So one can say that the first Latin American liberator or redeemer was a New Yorker. He lived in New York, and he absorbed the culture of journalism and thought, and he wrote wonderful essays and pieces on America's life in the 80s and 90s of 19th century. But all his mind was in liberating Cuba. But he foresaw very clearly the great perils of Cuba that Cuba would live in the 20th century. He saw, I do not like the idea of having Cuba just changing the dominion from Spain to the United States. But I don't like, neither do I like a caudillo, a strong man that liberating the country becomes the owner of the country. So I think he was a great prophet, aside from a wonderful writer and a very moving, he has a very moving and tragic personal life, and I was, very happy to start the book with this very emblematic figure.
And it's interesting because Martí actually died before the Spanish-American War, but the U.S. involvement in the expulsion of Spain proved him right in some ways.
Yes, Well, he is reclaimed as a hero by the Cubans in Miami and by the Cubans in Cuba. He is like the figure, but for different reasons. For some of them, he's a liberator. For the others, in Miami, he embodies the future liberation of Cuba. In any case, he wrote extensively, volumes and volumes. And in my piece, what I did is mainly to read his letters, the five volume of his letters, and his life in New York. Any New Yorker, and I would even say an American, would be very moved to know that such a distinguished man of letters was a witness of American life in the late 19th century.
It also seems that in his concern about Calillo, he predicted the rise of a figure like Fidel Castro.
In a way, yes. There is a moment when he writes to a famous general that was the leader of the two defeated revolutions in the late 19th century within Cuba against Spain, and he tells him exactly that. I hate the idea of a tyrant. He used the word tyrant in my country. But I must say that Martí was not a revolutionary in the, of course, in the sense that we had revolution in the 20th century, because he died in 1895. And he even has a very interesting piece on Marx's death in 1883. Mm. And he says, I respect Marx, but I don't like the gospel of class hatred that he embodies and that I find in his writings. Martí is like classic liberal, the last classic liberal liberator of Latin America. He is more, he's closer, let's say, to Bolívar, even though Bolívar was a general, but Bolívar was himself a wonderful, great man of letters.
So you write next about José Enrique Rodó of Uruguay, and he was really eager to assert the cultural superiority of Latin America based on its ties to European thinking. Tell us about Rodó.
Yeah, Rodó is a person very little known in America, and even in Latin America, almost everyone has forgotten this solitary, reclusive professor of Uruguay. He wrote a little book, Chris, called Ariel. And this little book portrayed Latin America as the true inheritor, Latin American culture, of the classic tradition of France, of Greece, of even of Spain. And he saw the Americans as purely materialistic. And in this contrast between strong, mighty, materialistic, money-oriented, success-oriented Americans and spiritual, poetic, culture, literary Latin Americans is a subject that we have all through our history. And you have it in the poetry of Darío. But this man, Enrique Rodó, a professor in Uruguay, a fine writer, wrote this tiny book, little book, or small book, that had an immense influence in Latin America. I can tell you something that is curious. I myself read it in 1959 when I was in school.
Huh.
And I was 12 years old. And I remember the teacher saying, you must read this book because this explains why, even though Latin America is poor in its in its material life, it's rich in its spiritual resources. I happen to think that this romantic idealist idea did a lot of harm to Latin America.
Hmm. Do you think, and again, I don't want to sound like an apologist for American materialism, but do you think some of that thinking had to do with the fact that, well, if we cannot have wealth right now to match other great powers in the region, then at least we will celebrate culture?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. This is clear. I'm not saying, you don't say it and I don't say it either. I think Latin America, it was only trying to compensate its inability to really build strong, modern, powerful industrial countries, for instance, and it compensated with the world of the spirit. There's something of it. But on the other hand, let's accept also, we have had quite a few wonderful figures in literary, in art. Let's say we are not third world, never have been in the subjects of art and literature. Mm-hmm. But in this particular political ideology, I have no doubt that it served as an alibi. For instance, I'm sure Che Guevara read that book. And the deep-seated hatred for the United States that, by the way, I think it's much deeper in Argentina and Uruguay than in the Caribbean. That's important, Chris, because in the Caribbean and in Mexico, it is a love-hate relation with the United States. But deep south, in Argentina, that was such a powerful country in the beginning of the 20th century, how do you explain its decline? So the Uruguayans developed a strange kind of hatred, I would say, to America, and that we don't feel in Mexicans, and I don't think we feel it in the Caribbeans. There's more ambivalence here.
What ongoing role did Rodot envision for the Catholic Church in the development of Latin America?
Pardon me, the Church?
Yes.
Well, I think the Church is the basic mental, institutional, spiritual structure of Latin America, from Argentina to Mexico. There are obviously strong differences. Mexico is much more deep, the imprint of the Church, than in Argentina, but you have it everywhere. So there is a missionary, that's an important word, a missionary zeal in the founding of these societies. The idea that Indians have to be redeemed from their condition, and the priests and the Jesuits and the Franciscans and the Augustines are the ones who in the Church will save them. So I think through the centuries, this spirit of redeeming the poor and the Indian traveled through the centuries, and there's something of that spirit in the 20th century redeemers that I study.
My guest is journalist and author Enrique Krause. His new book is called Redeemers, Ideas and Power in Latin America. You can now read the book in its paperback edition. If you'd like to join the conversation, we've got lines open at 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org. We'll be back in a couple of minutes.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Classes are available in everything from fine arts to personal finance. Fall registration is now open. You can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is journalist Enrique Krause. He is author of the book Redeemers, Ideas and Power in Latin America. If you'd like to join the conversation, call us. The number is 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Enrique, the next prominent figure in this book is the Mexican philosopher José Vasconcelos, who would go on to serve as the country's Secretary of Education in the 1920s. How did Vasconcelos build on Rodot's earlier ideas?
Well, Vasconcelos believed very firmly that Latin America had this special gift, historical gift, of being the mystical capital of the spirit. But he turned it into an educational crusade. Nothing of the sort happened in Latin America or in Mexico since the 16th century, when the Christian missionaries, the Franciscans and Jesuits and Augustines and Dominicans, all were traveling, were going to every place in the country in order to bring their evangelical message to the Indians. And Vasconcelos, four centuries later, in only 3 years, staged the most extraordinary educational crusade. And just to give you one example, the famous murals of Diego Rivera and Orozco and Siqueiros that many people have seen were originally meant as a kind of religious painting, as in the 16th century we had also in the churches, in order to teach the Mexican people what their life is and their future should be. So he was an educational redeemer. But he also was a very self-centered man who truly believed that he was like the Mexican Messiah. And he ended up, and for me it is very sad, but it's also very telling, in the 30s and 40s, becoming a very prominent Mexican supporter of Hitler.
Can you see the seeds of that in his early writings, Enrique?
You see, when one man thinks of himself as a savior of a country, one thing you can say is that he's not a Democrat. And he truly believed that. Some other figures in the 20th century later of an opposite ideology, let's say Fidel Castro or Hugo Chavez for that matter, they see themselves as the embodiment of their countries and chosen by the people to rule forever in order to save them from the wicked world, ways of the world. And yes, Vasconcelos felt of himself like that, and there are some writings of his. He's, by the way, Chris, an extraordinary writer and storyteller, and his memoirs are one of the most extraordinary documents in Mexican literature. But, yes, I see that if a man is so self-centered as to feel himself as a redeemer, he always has the risk of becoming a dictator.
So the fourth major figure in this book, another José, by the way, that must be a very good name.
How many Josés?
Four in a row. José Carlos Mariátegui, who sort of took up the cause of indigenous culture as a valid and an important thing, which was at the time a sort of revolutionary idea in and of itself.
Yes. No, I admire very much Mariátegui. Mariátegui died very young. He had a severe illness. He had a problem he couldn't walk, and a problem with arms, severely disabled. At the same time, he had an extraordinary mind. He lived in Italy. He became a Marxist, and he came to Peru, and he created a strange, very original blend of Marxism and indigenism. He saw the future of communism in the past, the future of communism in the past Inca civilization. He was a great dreamer. But I have read the extraordinary magazine that he published. He was an editor. And let me tell you, had I lived in the 20s, I would have been a Freudian Marxist and indigenist as he was. Mm. And by the way, he died in 1931, and his prophecy finally, many, many years ago, I think in my book I talk about that, was taken by the famous subcommander Marcos in Mexico. The same idea of the Indians, the Indian past as having the redeeming features to organize a more just and fair and harmonious society. I personally, of course, do not believe in that kind of Arcadia, but I think it's very respectable. And Mariátegui was a remarkable figure.
And when you talk about what happened later, you're referring to the Chiapas uprisings.
Yes, mm-hmm. Exactly. And those are the silent, like the communicating, like the uniting threads in my book, subtle echoes that you find when someone in the late 20th century reads someone in the early 20th century, and he turns that doctrine into practice.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We're speaking this hour with journalist Enrique Krause, whose book is called Redeemers, Ideas and Power in Latin America. Let's speak now to Hildardo in Richardson. Hi, how are you doing, Hildardo?
Hi, I'm very excited to hear Mr. Enrique Krause on radio here in Dallas. I'm actually from Mexico, and I love to read his books. And I have a question for him. Mr. Krause, how would you explain the independence of Brazil that was so smooth and basically with no violence at all? I don't know if you have a theory for that, or if you can explain us in more detail what happened in Brazil.
Sadly, I have some echo, Chris.
Hildardo was asking, can you rephrase the
question?
Absolutely. He was asking about why Brazil was able to transition so successfully and non-violently.
Perfect. Mm-hmm. Great question. I have no Brazilian redeemers in my book because politically I do not believe that Brazil had these kind of figures. And I think it has to do with many things. First of all, the birth of Brazil. In contrast with the attitude of Spain towards Spanish America, where we had this bloody wars of independence that almost destroyed entire countries. Venezuela was almost destroyed during the war, and Mexico also. In contrast, Portugal was very wise to send a king. So you had a kingdom, and you could say that the birth of Brazil was of natural, happy birth. And Spanish America, the countries were where it was a very brutal, traumatic birth. I think that is one reason. And you see the country. There is the zeal, the hatred, the civil wars. There were wars, of course, within Brazil in the late 80s of 19th century, but nothing in comparison. I see Brazil as a much more self-confident, outward-looking, less traumatized society, and it shows in its current development.
Is it somehow a sign that a society is not wholly healthy if it needs or wants a redeemer?
Probably yes, because I don't know, happiness is too much of a word, but I know what you mean, and you are right. Let me try to explain. For instance, Chile, for instance, and even Uruguay, Costa Rica, they've had their difficult periods. But all in all, Uruguay, Chile have been democratic republics since the mid-19th century. And look at them. Even though they had their difficult times, we all remember Allende and Pinochet, they are very developed politically. They have a civic culture. They have had elections. And let me bring also the case of Colombia. Colombia has had a very violent life, history, but elections since the 30s, 170 years of elections. So Colombia has a civic political culture. It's a democratic country, and they haven't had this kind of figures. You don't find in Colombia a figure like Hugo Chavez, like Fidel Castro, like other figures that I study in my book. So yes, I think there is a correlation between political life and maturity and democracy and the more democratic, the less you need a redemptive figure. You need leadership. But to have a leader is not a redeemer. I mean, Winston Churchill or Roosevelt, for that matter, were great leaders, but they were not redeemers. You cannot understand them through the light of religion. In Latin America, religion is a key to understand history.
You devote a good part of this book to Octavio Paz, who, among other things, was a good friend and a mentor to you.
Yes.
Talk a little bit about his remarkable life and the ideological transitions that he underwent over that lifetime.
I met him in 1976, and I worked with him, and I was his friend until his death in 1998. He was the son of the secretary of Emiliano Zapata, and was the grandson of a great liberal rebel of the 19th century. So being such a son, such a grandson, Octavio had to become, young Octavio, more revolutionary than his father and grandfather. Mm-hmm. And he became very early in his life, in 1920s, he was born in 1914, and he became a Marxist, active Marxist. He wrote Marxist poems, he read Marxist books, he believed in the demise of the capitalism. He did not believe in democracy and liberal democracy. And he went to Spain in the Civil War. And he was had great renown as a poet being young. But slowly, because he was a man of tremendous honesty and intelligence, he started opening his eyes to what was happening in Russia. Russia seemed to be the land of the future for them, for that generation. But Octavio started to learn, not unlike Kessler or Orwell or some other figures in the English letters, started to open his eyes to the trials of Moscow, to the truth of the concentration camps in Russia, and slowly began parting ways with that world and that ideological tradition. His taking of distance took a lot of time. In fact, I think that even in the 60s, as late as the 60s, he still considered himself a socialist, not a communist, not a Marxist. Hmm. But then came the Gulag Archipelago of Solzhenitsyn. And I can tell you that I met him in those days, and he had undergone a kind of religious conversion. He discovered liberalism. He discovered democracy. He discovered that the tradition of liberty, or he rediscovered, should I say, because those were the great books that he read, that he saw in the library of his grandfather. So this remarkable man and poet and essayist, Nobel Prize in 1990, started writing essays and poems explaining with a sense of contrition that this generation was wrong. That whatever are the wrongs of the Western civilization and of Europe and the United States, and there are many wrongs and many misdeeds, the Chinese and the Cuban and the Russian Revolution ended up being totalitarian States, and he denounced that until the end of his life. He was happy enough to live 89 and to see the fall of the Iron Curtain. But he did not become a neoconservative or a conservative or a cheap anti-communist. He was always a very complex man. He became a liberal and a Democrat, but he always, until his last minute, you could find in him the romantic man that thought that, well, democracy and the free market cannot be the utmost ultimate goal of human societies.
It's interesting that he was still undergoing this transition at the time of the Cuban Revolution. Can you talk about sort of how he processed that in the moment?
Yeah, he was old enough at that moment to have seen what had happened in Russia.
Mm-hmm.
So he welcomed with lots of, with some concern and with reserves, the Cuban Revolution, unlike his many friends, young friends, like Mario Vargas Llosa, García Márquez, Carlos Fuentes, the boom generation of novelists that embraced the Cuban Revolution with great enthusiasm. Octavio did not embrace it with that enthusiasm because, let's say, he had seen the picture before. And, slowly, many of those writers, I would say almost all of them, except the great García Márquez, parted ways with the revolution, with Castro, in the late 60s. Octavio was old enough. He was 40 years old in 64, and he wrote letters and he said, no, I want a revolution to be Martí, not Lenin. And it ended up more like Lenin than Martí. He said that.
Enrique Krause is my guest. He's a journalist and author of the book Redeemers, Ideas and Power in Latin America. The book's out now in paperback. If you'd like to join us, the telephone number is 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Classes are available in everything from fine arts to personal finance. Fall registration is now open. You can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is journalist and author Enrique Krause. His new book is called Redeemers, Ideas and Power in Latin America. If you would like to join the conversation, call us. The number is 1-800-933-5372. Enrique, the next figure that you treat in this book is Eva Perón, who you call the greatest female demagogue of the 20th century. And her story is so interesting because in some ways she was redeemed by her association with and marriage to Juan Perón, and then she saw herself very much as a redeemer of her people.
Absolutely, and she saw herself, but the main thing is that people saw herself like that and still see her like that. In a way, you can say, in a way, that Cristina Kirchner, when she won the second election, she had the famous portrait of Eva, saying that Eva lives, and the people in the street saying Eva lives because they, the Argentinas, lived that those years, 40s and early 50s, before her early death. She died tragically from cancer. 33-year-old, Eva Perón embodied like a kind of virgin savior. All the people, the writers and thinkers and authors and leaders that I study in my book, in some parts of their life, they thought of themselves as redeemers. Octavio Paz himself wrote, when I was young, I pictured myself, I thought of myself as a hero, a revolutionary, and a redeemer. Well, Eva Perón obviously saw herself and people saw her as a redeemer. The only problem, of course, is that I don't think redemption is of this life. I mean, the redemption is a very serious and important and even mystical term in the realm of religion. I think believers are what they are because they believe in the possibility of redemption in other world, for instance. But when you take the practice and belief of redemption through the political arena, which is in itself impure and difficult and treacherous, as human lives and human histories, then you end up having dictatorships. And a dictator she was, because she simply almost suppressed the judiciary, the legislative, the free press. She concentrated power with her husband in Argentina. And I venture to tell you that had she outlived and had she been healthy, I wouldn't have been surprised that she would have been the president, the eternal president of Argentina. She admired very much Catherine of Russia, and Catherine of Russia, as you might know, decided that her husband shouldn't leave and that she was much more entitled to rule Russia. Well, I think we would have had our Catherine of Argentina.
Meanwhile, throughout the Perón regime, this vast wealth that had existed in Argentina essentially imploded.
Well, you see, that's the tragedy. She felt a redeemer, not only a populist, a redeemer. How do you relieve people? Well, you have the huge crowds of people that are poor. She took directly the immense wealth she and her husband that Argentina had accumulated during the wealthy decades, that very wealthy country in the 19th and early 20th century, and just give it away. But she and Perón kept an important part of that wealth in their private accounts.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak to Mike in Dallas. Hello, Mike.
Hello, I'm enjoying the program. Thank you. I have really two questions. One is, how does Marxism address the distribution of power and, you know, the corruption that can accompany their pockets of power? And how can we address and avoid the problems of motivation being impeded by Marxist, by an implementation, say, of a socialist state? And then I guess lastly, I wondered, does your guest see the current election as a choice between socialism and capitalism? Thank you.
Thanks for your call.
Again, can you? It's a question about the role of Marxism in Latin America, no?
Yes, about its impact on the distribution of power and corruption, and on whether or not I think it impedes motivation.
Well, you see, I think Marxism was in the Latin American. I studied in the book in detail, and I think it was one of the, you could say, a very powerful redeeming ideology, the main redeeming ideology in Latin America, and there we have it in Cuba still to this moment, and we have it in many universities and in Latin America. Someone said that the last Marxist on earth will die in a Latin American university. Maybe it's true. And you have it in Venezuela, not as a Marxist, but the idea of socialism in the 21st century. I think, of course, that Marxism, as Marx's work, was very important, very influential, and in many ways for good reasons. But in Latin America, it was taken as a revolutionary credo, and we ended up by having the experiment in Cuba, which ended up in a totalitarian society and in a very poor country. You know, I think Marxism as such it does not have a future in 21st century Latin America, but we still are not social democratic modern countries. We still have the temptation of searching for one leader that could save the country. You have it in Mexico with this very impressive figure of Andrés Manuel López Obrador that has been in two elections, successive elections, with millions of people believing in him and voting for him. And I have called him, and I it wasn't meant not as a joke, not as nothing, but as a description. I called him the Messiah. Mm-hmm. And I think many people see him as a Messiah. And there is no Marxism in him. There is just the populist drive to help the people, and people believing that the only way out is through a savior.
Again, this idea of the faith in the savior, do you think that keeps people from feeling that as individuals they have power to sort of save themselves?
I have no doubt. I think there is an inherent tension between democracy and redemption. As we live it, democracy means that individuals take charge. They have their vote. They have their vote, and they have criticism, and we are. But Latin America, for the first time, has been almost all Latin America. We had democratic regimes aside from Cuba since the 90s. Already we have more than 20 good years of learning the importance of an individual that believes in himself and has rights and has obligations, has responsibilities, and has a vote. But a democratic culture is something that England or the United States centuries to build, and I think Latin America is slowly but clearly heading towards democracy. But the redemptionist, the populist temptation runs against it.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Joshua in Garland. Hi, Joshua.
Hello, Ms. Boyd. Kudos again for choosing such an interesting and well-informed guest. We are enjoying this show.
Thank you.
My question to your guest is, in this pantheon of Latin American thinkers and doers and speakers, where would you place the Jesuit priest Miguel Hidalgo and that fiery sermon that he delivered, which started the 1810 revolution, Independencia of Mexico? Was he having an original spiritual, moral, conscience thought that he was striking an original match? Or was he inevitable to combust because of a stream of philosophy that was happening, which literally that metaphysical sermon became the torch that Pipila carried to the gates of the Alhóndiga? Where would you place him? Did he have a self-awareness as a redeemer, or was he merely speaking as a man of God with a conscience?
What a wonderful question. In my first book, Biography of Power, I think I touch, and the answer is I have no doubt that Hidalgo felt himself as a redeemer of the true Mexican people against the Spanish oppressors, and people saw him like that. And I only tell you there's a line that someone talked to the Indians that were following him, and they said, "Why are you following the priest Hidalgo?" And they said, we want to bring Hidalgo to his throne so he can be the master and the king of Mexico. So, yes, there was a flame, there was a fire in his life and in his the way Orozco depicts him with a fire. He set the Mexico on fire. He saw himself as a redeemer. But again, my book was very thick and I wanted to touch mainly on the 20th century tradition. But now you see that the redeeming drive it can be traced to the even to the late 18th, early 19th century.
As we come to the end of this hour, I don't want to miss discussing Hugo Chavez, who you have said is a caricature of Castro, but a caricature who happens to have oil and billions of dollars.
Yes. I went to Venezuela in 2007 and 8, and I even wrote a book on Chavez. And this chapter in my book, the last chapter, is a short version of that book. I think Hugo Chavez embodies the title of my book very clearly. He sees Bolivar as the great liberator in 19th century, Castro as the towering figure of redeeming Latin America in the 20th century, and he used to see himself and still sees himself as the towering founder of the socialism in the 21st century. I want to tell you that even though I'm very critical of Hugo Chavez, extremely, deeply critical, because I don't think he's a Democrat, he does not believe in the rule of law, in he's not a tolerant man in any ways, I do believe that he has a genuine social vocation to help the poor. And the last sentence in my book is that poverty is truly the soil where you can expect and keep expecting these figures to rise. Mm. I mean, democracy, I believe strongly in democracy for Latin America. But if democracy doesn't deliver also economic growth and social justice and some kind of leveling to the very deep inequality of that many of these countries have, well, there will always be people searching for redeemers.
The newest book by journalist and author Enrique Krause is called Redeemers, Ideas and Power in Latin America. The book is available now in both hardback and paperback. Enrique, it's been a fascinating discussion. Thank you so much for spending this hour with
us. It's been wonderful. Thank you for reading and for asking these questions, and I hope to be in your program again.
You'd be welcome back. Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Joe Bellotti answers the phones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. Jeff Whittington is senior producer. Learn more about Think, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcast online at kera.org/think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.